Since Job first opened his mouth with words of lament in chapter 3, he has been asking why. Why is this happening to me? Why have I lost everything that I valued, everything that brought joy to my life, my possessions, my position in society, my family, the loyalty of my wife, my health? It's all gone. I am miserable. My life is a wreck. Why, Lord? Why should this be? What have I done to deserve such treatment from the hand of God? Why, Lord, why? I think that's a question that we all deal with at some degree when tragedy strikes and we're in times of suffering and pain, and no doubt there are lots of people asking that very question down in Parkland, Florida, after yet another school shooting. We want answers. We want to know how to manage life in this fallen world, a world full of heartache. How does all this stuff we encounter in this life make any sense at all? The why question. It's really a question in search of meaning in our pain. What could conceivably be the purpose of God in allowing such anguish in my life? What value could it possibly have? It's a quest for wisdom in how to live. Wisdom. I define wisdom as the best way to the best end. You see, it involves both means and ends. It must. You see, a person could be a very effective thief, but we'd hardly call that person wise. Or a person could have the best intentions in the world, but have no clue as to how to fulfill them. That person would not be wise either. No, it must include both. Wisdom is the best way to the best end. And in that sense, wisdom is more than just knowledge. Wisdom involves making value judgments about what is worth pursuing. It includes the will to pursue it. And so you often hear of the person who climbed the ladder of corporate success only to realize at the top that he was leaning against the wrong wall. We all need wisdom. And you might say that the quest for wisdom is fundamental to being human. It's our defining struggle. It's why Jamie Smith, in his book, You Are What You Love, says to be human is to be animated and orientated by some vision of the good life, some picture of what we think counts as flourishing. It's that picture that attracts us, one that we imagine often in a visceral, unarticulated way. But we want that. We crave it. We desire it. This is why our most fundamental mode of orientation to the world is love. You see, wisdom comes in formulating a vision for one's life that entails the best way to the best end. And it includes a desire or a love for that good life. And Job's struggle can be seen as a part of that quest for wisdom. What does it mean to live wisely in a world of pain and hardship? But where can wisdom be found? Who can answer Job's most perplexing questions? Who has the wisdom to address his agonizing circumstances? Well, Job's friends think that they do. And so they come to console him. They come to offer comfort with the hope of drawing him out of his state of mourning. They begin well. But after Job moves from words of pious praise to expressing how he really feels, they cannot help but try to be the voice of wisdom, that voice that provides what Job so desperately longs for. They think they know the answer to Job's calamity. Job, you must have sinned. So repent, and your prosperity will be restored. But Job knows, and we as readers also know, that they are wrong. And so in the course of their interaction, Job mocks their presumptuous claim to know what God is up to in his case. Job says, doubtless you are the people of wisdom, then wisdom is going to die with you. Do you listen in on God's counsel? Do you limit wisdom to yourself? What advice you have offered to one without wisdom, and what great insight you have displayed. If only you would be altogether silent. For you, that would be wisdom. Job scoffs at their claim to have the wisdom that would comfort him in his pain. Now, Job ends his fiery response to his friends in chapter 27. And he will offer a final and dramatic challenge to God in chapters 29 to 31. In between, we have our passage for this morning, Job chapter 28. Job chapter 28 comes as the eye of the storm, a calm reprieve from a tumultuous clash, in contrast to the passionate and combative dialogue of the previous chapters and with what follows. This chapter seems peaceful and untroubled. It has a serene and tranquil mood, totally unexpected in the context of what's been happening. And it seems to have no clear connection with what comes before or after. Also, it has no reference to Job as the speaker, as we find at the beginning of chapters 26 and 27 and again in 29. Now, these could well be the words of Job continuing from the previous chapter with a radical change of mood, perhaps explained by the emotional ups and downs of those in extreme pain and grief. But many others have suggested that this chapter actually comes from the author of the book. Given at this point where the dialogue between Job and his friends is broken down, providing some perspective on what has been happening. Well, either way, chapter 28 and its musings on wisdom provides a kind of parenthesis in the progress of the drama, offering some breathing space for us as readers in which we are given a thought-provoking interlude to reflect on where this story has gone. Its central question is very clear. It's given twice, verse 12 and verse 20. But where can wisdom be found? Where does understanding dwell? The answer it provides in verse 23 is just as straightforward. God understands the way to wisdom. He alone knows where it dwells. And this leads to its important conclusion in verse 28. And God said to man, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to shun evil is understanding. Wisdom, knowing the best way to the best end. The quest for wisdom is central to human life. So let's explore what this chapter tells us about such wisdom. The first 11 verses speak of the hiddenness of wisdom. And to make that point, the author first extols human ingenuity and courage in discovering and recovering the hidden treasures of this earth. There is a mine for silver and a place where gold is refined. Iron is taken from the earth. Copper is smelted from ore. Man puts an end to the darkness. He searches the farthest recesses for ore in the blackest darkness. Far from where people dwell, he cuts a shaft in places forgotten by the foot of man. Far from men, he dangles and sways, a reference there, I think, to men being lowered down on ropes through vertical shafts deep into the heart of the earth. These ancient engineers do what no animal would ever be capable of. Verse 7, no bird of prey knows that hidden path. No falcon's eye has seen it. Proud beasts do not set foot on it. No lion prowls there. No, this excavation of the earth is a magnificent human achievement. Verse 9, man's hand assaults the flinty rock and lays bare the roots of the mountains. He tunnels through the rocks. His eyes see all its treasures. He searches the sources of the rivers and brings hidden things to light. What a marvel. Even today, we can be amazed at mining and drilling techniques, ways that have been devised to acquire coal and precious stones and metals, and especially that black gold, oil, and natural gas. But our author tells us there is one thing human technology can never uncover in this world, and that is wisdom. Verse 12, but where can wisdom be found? Where does understanding dwell? And as we read in verse 21, it is hidden from the eyes of every living thing, concealed even from the birds of the air. Now we live in a scientific age. And the success of science in enabling us to understand the material world around us and to control it and to harness it for our welfare, this amazing success has made scientific knowledge the gold standard, and for many, even the only standard when it comes to claiming to know anything. the methods of science, its empirical research, observing, measuring, making things quantifiable, the testing of hypotheses, peer review, its objective assessment of evidence, and the technology that flows out of that scientific discovery, these have brought tremendous benefits to our lives. I think, for example, of healthcare and computer technology, the internet, and all the rest. I mean, would any of us really want to go back in time before aspirin and anesthesia, before smartphones and GPS? But what we sometimes forget is that science and technology, despite their success, they still have nothing to say about what is good or what is bad, what is right, what is wrong, what is valuable, and what is worthless. You see, science can only observe and predict. It cannot make judgments of value. The scientific method cannot demonstrate even that torturing babies is wrong. Can't do it. Renowned atheist Richard Dawkins states it as starkly as it can be said when he writes, "Science has no methods for deciding what is ethical." It has no methods. Science is a wonderful tool, but it is only one tool among others by which we come to know things. And in fact, science is incapable of knowing the most important things, the most personal of things. And our passage this morning tells us that one of the things that science and technology cannot discover is wisdom. It cannot fathom the deepest questions of the human heart, questions of meaning and purpose. It cannot move from what is to what ought to be. Science can be of great help with finding the best means, but it is of little value in determining the best ends. I mean, if I know where I want to go, the GPS can tell me how to get there. But it can't tell me why I ought to go to one place rather than another. It can't tell me whether my destination should be Sunday school or a strip club. You see, science can never tell us what human beings are for. It can never tell us what constitutes a good human life, what makes for real human happiness. I saw an illustration of this limitation this week in an article describing the growing disillusionment with internet dating sites. It says, the singles of Silicon Valley, the very heart of America's technological ambition, spend much of their lives in quiet devotion to the power of the almighty algorithm, driven by the belief that technology can solve the world's most troubling ills. But when it comes to the algorithms of love, many say they are losing faith. They wonder whether Silicon Valley has proved too vexing for even its own dating apps. But they're also left with a more fundamental doubt. Maybe the human mysteries of chemistry and attraction aren't problems big data can solve. I think of the lines of a poem by Edna St. Vincent Millay. Upon this gifted age, in its dark hour, rains from the sky a meteoric shower of facts. They lie unquestioned, uncombined. Wisdom enough to leech us of our ill is daily spun, but there exists no loom to weave it into fabric. Yes, we are inundated daily with a veritable meteoric shower of facts. Information abounds. But there exists no loom to weave these facts into the fabric of wisdom. You see, despite its great power, science and the human ingenuity it demonstrates, it fails us. But where can wisdom be found? Where does understanding dwell? Well, next our author moves from the hiddenness of wisdom to its supreme value. Verse 13, man does not comprehend its worth. Verse 15, wisdom cannot be bought with the finest gold, nor can its price be weighed in silver. The most expensive jewels, onyx, sapphires, or the beautiful blue stone, lapis lazuli, nor coral, nor jasper, none of them are its equal. Verse 18, the price of wisdom is beyond rubies. The topaz of Kush cannot compare with it. It cannot be bought with pure gold. You see, not only is wisdom not the kind of thing that can be bought, its value is beyond any price that anyone could pay. And intuitively, we know this to be true. I mean, I ask you, are the 100 richest people in the world the 100 wisest? Are they the 100 happiest? If they could buy what wisdom offers, surely they would. But they can't. Wisdom can't be bought. Jesus certainly confronted us with this truth. The rich young man who came to him desperately wanted the wisdom that Jesus had, but his wealth was not only irrelevant, it was in fact a hindrance. It blinded him to the one thing he lacked. What good will it be if someone gains the whole world yet forfeits their soul, Jesus asked? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? Wisdom. Man does not comprehend its worth. The price of wisdom is beyond rubies. The topaz of Cush cannot compare with it. It cannot be bought with pure gold. Where then does wisdom come from? Where does understanding dwell? The hiddenness of wisdom, the value of wisdom. And the author moves in the final section to his central point. Verse 21, wisdom is hidden from the eyes of every living thing, concealed even from the birds of the air. Destruction and death say only a rumor of it has reached our ears. God understands the way to it, and he alone knows where wisdom dwells. You see, there are some things that only God can tell us, and wisdom is one of them. Only God knows the best way to the best end in human life. And that shouldn't surprise us. I mean, we are finite creatures. We're limited in space and time. We live in the present with some knowledge of the past, but we're totally ignorant about the future. We're caught up in the ebb and flow of life on this horizontal frame. We can only see bits and pieces. Our vision is narrow. We need someone who can see the whole, the beginning and the end. It's as if we sit in the airport terminal at the gate, waiting for our plane to take us where we want to go, but we want to be in the control tower with the air traffic controllers, knowing where all the planes are, where they've come from, where they're going. But you see, only God can do that. God alone knows where wisdom dwells, we read. Verse 24, for he views the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heaven. God is the creator. He's the divine architect of the cosmos. He's the one who knows how we are designed to live and what we are made to live for. Who else could tell us the way to true human flourishing? The Bible declares that God created the world with wisdom at his side. We heard that in our reading from Psalm 8, didn't we? There, Lady Wisdom declares, I was there when he set the heavens in place, when he marked out the horizon on the face of the deep, when he established the clouds above and fixed supremely the fountains of the deep. Then I was the craftsman at his side. You see, this world was created with a divine order. God's wisdom. And it was that biblical expectation of order that actually gave rise to modern science in the West. Natural laws embedded by God in the cosmos lay waiting to be discovered by human observation. That's the fundamental presupposition of modern science. And in our passage, this connection between wisdom and the natural world is affirmed, but with a very interesting twist. Look at verse 25. When God established the force of the wind and measured out the waters, when he made a decree for the rain and a path for the thunderstorm, then he looked at wisdom and appraised it. He confirmed it and tested it. You see, God in his wisdom is the guiding force, ordering the winds that blow here and there, the waters of the seas that ebb and flow, the rains that come in their seasons, even the paths of the thunderstorms with their lightning bolts that strike with apparent randomness. All these unpredictable and sometimes wild forces of the weather, God in his wisdom has established, measured, decreed. God created them. God rules over them. They all submit to his divine will. And this ought to be assuring to us. You see, we can live in the conviction that this is not a chaotic universe. It's a universe built upon a fundamental, underlying, and majestic order. And so we can expect the sun to rise tomorrow, just like today. I can look forward to the anticipation of spring to bring its flowers in abundance. But what is striking in this passage is that those manifestations of God's wisdom, the wind, the waters, the rain, and the thunderstorm, they're all ambiguous when it comes to human well-being. Yes, they can be forces for good, providing, among other things, a fruitful environment in which to produce crops for food. But these forces also pose a threat. After all, it was a mighty wind that caused the house to collapse, resulting in the deaths of Job's sons and daughters. It was the fire from heaven, lightning from a thunderstorm, that burned up his sheep and his servants. Is that too a demonstration of wisdom? It gives us pause to think and reflect. Well, this poem on divine wisdom comes to a decisive conclusion in verse 28. And God said to man, "The fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to shun evil is understanding." Now, many of you will recognize this as a familiar theme in the book of Proverbs, though there it's stated slightly differently. I refer to Proverbs 9, verse 10. "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." Well, here it's stated even more strongly. "The fear of the Lord, that is wisdom." And you see, wisdom here is essentially relational. It comes through relating to God. It's found in fearing Him, that is, relating to God in awe, recognizing Him as the God that He is, holy and majestic, full of glory. And because He is righteous, this relationship necessarily has a moral dimension. It includes turning away from that which is evil. Having this relationship with God, fearing God, that is wisdom. You see, the knowledge that comes through this relationship, it's not scientific. It is personal. This is personal knowledge. And you see, this is what science can never comprehend. At its deepest level, this cosmos that we live in, and we as human beings are at our most fundamental levels, personal. Personal. We're not just material objects. And the world we live in is not, it doesn't simply exist as an autonomous, material entity, self-existing, self-contained, self-sufficient. No, we ourselves and the universe we live in, we have a personal source, the mind of God. And all of creation has been created for a divine purpose, and it will, in one way or another, display a divine glory. And for that reason, we can only gain wisdom, the understanding of the meaning of things, the purpose of things, the ultimate value of things. That wisdom can only come through a relationship with the personal God who created us. You see, wisdom is not a thing to be discovered. It's a relationship to be lived. The fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. To shun evil is understanding. It is that relationship with God, our Creator, that is the only way to discover true wisdom. For God Himself is the best way to the best end. Now let me step back for a minute and try to draw out some implications of these reflections on divine wisdom. First, by considering the place of this chapter in Job's story. You see, some people see this chapter as the final answer to Job's plight, the grand climax to the book. Job just needs to fear God, and he will have the wisdom to deal with his tragic circumstances. Now, there's some truth to that, but I can't go along with it for two reasons. First, in the flow of the book, this chapter doesn't satisfy Job. His dispute with God will continue in the next three chapters with a renewed vehemence. And second, we're told in the very first verse of the book, and repeatedly in the opening chapters, that Job already feared God and shunned evil. If this is wisdom, he already had it. No, the story is not over. Job's struggle is still on. The resolution is yet to come. So what purpose does this chapter have in the drama? Well, let me suggest first that as a kind of interlude, it gives us a chance to catch our breaths. There are plenty more fireworks to come, and here we're given some space for some quiet reflection. We can reflect for a moment on where we are in the story. The debate is done, but nothing's been settled. No answers have been found, and God is still silent. The question of this chapter is natural at this point. Where then is wisdom to be found? And what we find in this chapter reinforces the failure of the friends. They have searched the world for wisdom, and they have failed. They have failed because true wisdom is not found in this world. It is hidden from our view. It must come from God. In addition to that, the emphasis of this chapter is on the value of wisdom, and it encourages us to think well of Job. For you see, Job refuses to give up in his quest for it. You see, most people would have quit long ago, taken one of those easy ways out that we talked about last week, either giving in to his despair or to his anger or giving up on his integrity or on God himself. Job doesn't do that. He presses his case because nothing is more precious to him than wisdom. He wants it desperately. And I think the conclusion of this chapter in verse 28 is also an encouragement to Job. For this description of wisdom is a description of Job himself. Job does fear God. He does shun evil, which means that Job is on the right track. Wisdom can only be found in a relationship with God, and that is what Job desires more than anything else. So in this chapter, in many ways, anticipates the divine speeches at the end, and it gives us hope that if Job continues to fear God and shun evil, then some resolution is possible. But what about us? What does this chapter teach us about wisdom in our lives? Well, for one thing, it reminds us that the quest for wisdom is a universal human occupation. And at the same time, that seeking it apart from God is a primal human sin. Doesn't Genesis 3 point to that? Doesn't the serpent tempt the woman to take what God had prohibited with the prospect that her eyes would be open and she would obtain wisdom? But you see, that's the way of death. For wisdom is the fear of God. It comes in relationship with God. Seeking our own wisdom apart from God destroys that relationship and cuts us off from the very source of wisdom itself. That's foolishness. And it's the opposite of faith. Listen again to the voice of Lady Wisdom in Proverbs 8. The Lord brought me forth as the first of his works. Then I was the craftsman at his side. Blessed are those who listen to me, watching daily at my doors, waiting at my doorway. For those who find me find life and receive favor from the Lord. Those who fail to find me harm themselves. All who hate me love death. You see, wisdom is a description of the way that God has ordered the world from the beginning. It's the way we're meant to live as human beings, showing the best means to the best end. Wisdom is the guiding principle of all of life, and God alone is the source of wisdom. Now listen to what the Apostle Paul writes in his letter to the Colossians. Colossians 1:15, he says, Jesus Christ is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. By him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things were created by him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. Do you see it? Do you see it? Jesus stands in the very place of God's wisdom. This divine wisdom, this guiding principle of creation, this final cause of all things, has become embodied in Jesus Christ. He is the very center of the cosmos. Jesus Christ is the one man who lived in all that wisdom is, living in a relationship of faith with his Father in heaven, fearing God and shunning evil fully and completely. It is Jesus who says, like wisdom, whoever listens to my words and puts them into practice will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. It is Jesus who says, like wisdom, I have come that you may have life and have it in all its fullness. So do you want to know what life is all about? Do you want to discover the meaning of life? Do you want to know how we're to live and to what end? Here we have it then. The key to understanding the whole of creation, the one who shows us what God had in mind when he created human beings in the first place. Here is the one who shows us how we are to live. Here is the one who shows us what we are here on this earth for. Here is the one who embodies the wisdom of God. And it's in the foolishness of the cross of Christ that we find the supreme expression of the wisdom of God. For wisdom is found in a relationship with him, with Jesus Christ. Whoever finds me finds life and receives favor from the Lord. These are the words of the wisdom of God. These are the words of Jesus Christ. As Paul says in Colossians 2, it is Christ in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. That wisdom can be found nowhere else. But I ask you, where are you looking for wisdom? There are always lots of voices crying out, claiming to give us wisdom. Do you look to Hollywood, to the emotive messages of its movies? Do you look to Madison Avenue and the images of the good life that bombard us in its advertising? Or do you listen to the voices of our culture, popular voices, whether from Oprah Winfrey or Joel Osteen or Kanye West or Matt Drudge? Where is wisdom to be found? As we wrestle with Job, we must keep looking to Jesus. For the answers that Job keeps seeking are ultimately found in a relationship with a person. That person who brings God's wisdom into our world. Well, let's pray. Let's pray.